Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Context of White Supremacy, Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. So I guess to make sure that we have clarity about what this is, this was Gus T. Renegade in Seattle, Washington. Dr. Vanessa Grubbs, she made a trip to Seattle, Washington to discuss her brand new book, Hundreds of Interlaced Fingers. It deals with her husband. She is a gorgeous black female. She's married to a black male. It talks about her husband who had to get a kidney transplant and what she learned in watching his ordeal. She ended up donating a kidney to her husband to save his life. And she talks about that experience and how racism impacted not just her husband and the availability of a kidney to him, but the widespread availability of organs to black people, that they tend not to be available, and that the organs of black people tend to be harvested where white people are getting lots and lots of organs. She touches on all of this in her book. I just heard about it. The book is brand new. It just came out this year. I had just played it. In fact, she did an interview on NPR, and I played a segment from that interview on the program about 2 weeks ago. I went to Third Place Books, an independent bookstore in Seattle, Washington, in northern Seattle, Washington. Lots of white people, very white area. And I went there for other purposes on this past Sunday. I saw that Dr. Grubbs was going to be there, and I was so excited, like, oh my gosh, I just saw this. She was talking all about racism, and I want to check this out. Then, as I continued to think about it, I said, wait a minute. I mean, it would be difficult for me to paint the picture, but I was in this environment at this bookstore in a super white neighborhood. There was not another black person anywhere, and I felt the gaze of race soldiers looking like, whoa, we are not accustomed to having Negroes in our bookstore in these parts. Where did you come from? When are you? That was the type of feel that it had, and this was like Sunday midday, right? Early. And so I said, there's no way. I'm going to tell you my exact thought process. There's no way they're going to have a book study here in Lake Forest Park around all these whites on a book that is explicitly about racism and how whites, like the people that live here, are feasting off the organs of black people and pussyfoot the dialogue, not talk about racism, not have any black people present, and then just give some nonsense little, you know, superficial discussion and call it. When I said, no, that's not going to happen at all. I'm going to take time out of my schedule. When I saw this event, I saw that it was on a Thursday. I saw it was timed with workplace racism, which would mean a lot of extra work for me and maybe even some shifting with the program. But I knew I was going to make time to attend. I'm so glad I did. There's so much more I could say about it. I almost feel like you could listen to the NPR interview to really get the full backstory, to really appreciate this conversation and the way that, you know, it evolved. Because the NPR story is short. It's only like 4 or 5 minutes, but they go right to the point about racial disparities in organ transplants. That's one of the central themes of the book. And that just was not the way that the discussion evolved this evening. Again, this took place on Thursday evening, July 13th, 2017 at Third Place Books in Seattle, Washington at 7 p.m. Eastern. Because Gus T. Renegade had to end the program, the Workplace Racism broadcast, and then run upstairs from the library to the Third Place Books bookstore, I missed like the first 5 minutes of the presentation, but I got the rest of it. The other error, I wish I had continued recording after the end of the presentation, because so many white people came up to talk to me after it was over. A white person even feigning nervousness said, "It's such a difficult conversation to have." And I said, "Why?" And he got even more nervous. And he said, "Oh, just because I'm a white man and these things did happen and it is true." And I wish I had continued recording once it ended, because of the people that talked to me and because I spoke with Dr. Grubbs after all of this was over. She called me militant. And she said that, in quote, she said, "I had planned not to talk about racism." I was mystified. I was stunned. I have so much to say about this. I have so much to say about this. I'm just uploading this so that the audio commentary is available. People can check it out if they want. And I will make sure to say a word about this during the compensatory call-in on this coming Saturday, July 15th. Without further ado, this is Dr. Vanessa Grubbs discussing her book, Hundreds of Interlaced Fingers, Context of White Supremacy.
I think it brings up a lot of the issues that people in the situation of needing a kidney transplant really feel. The first time I said to him, "You know, I think we should see if I could give you one of my kidneys," he said, "No, I don't want to do that." And I didn't really understand it until we thought about it. And basically it's because, you know, it's a lot of pressure to get a gift like that from someone, a gift that cannot ever be repaid. And for someone like my husband, who's a, you know, a very independent person, someone who he saw himself as being able to take care of himself and not need others to help him. And so to have a kidney for me was like the ultimate like slap in the face of needing somebody and having a gift like that. And I think we really thought about it, because I, in my training, I came across two different examples of how people not really celebrate it, but acknowledge the transplant. And one was this really wonderful story about a colleague who donated to her best friend. And every year, the best friend would organize for them to be out all day, and it would just be about the two of them. And on the other end of the spectrum, there was this couple, and I met them because the man, the recipient, was in the hospital yet again with another kind of, the kidney was rejecting because he wouldn't take his medications properly. And the wife was all like, "Oh my God, I don't know what to do. This is just, I don't know how to get him to take his medications." And you know, I felt like he was like literally pissing away her gift by not taking the medications. And, you know, my comment to her was like, "I think you've kind of done your part." So there's a section in the book where I asked Robert, "So what are we going to do for, you know, transplant anniversary?" And he's like, "I don't know." And it reminded me of that bad end of the spectrum. So, but it all really came to him feeling like he was showing me his gratitude every day by taking care of the kidney, and he felt like I was kind of, you know, being selfish a bit or whatever to expect him to acknowledge me. And at the same time, I was like, "Well, I can't even get a thank you once a year. Is that asking too much?" So that was a lot of the story, and really made me see kind of how intense. And mm-hmm. because, you know, if you get a kidney from a deceased person and something goes wrong with it, then, you know, okay, there's nobody yeah. looking at you, right. nobody to judge you or say anything about it. But right. with a living donor, it's a little different.
Yeah. And, you know, that kind of reminds me also of something you said, that when you first brought up the idea of giving him a kidney, it reminded you of when you you'd also suggested that you both have a baby in together early in your relationship, and you noticed it was kind of the same reaction, a real reluctance, and you came to understand that as him being in this place while he was on dialysis where he really couldn't let himself plan for the future.
Right.
For the future. And you do such a, I guess that sort of leads me to another sort of question or point, which is I think knowing Robert as you do and having lived, experienced with him being on dialysis, you have this very unique perspective on what that experience is like.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a big part of it is that sort of kind of slow motion, you know, being reluctant to plan for the future. But you also talk about some really pragmatic things like being thirsty all the time, mm-hmm. but not being able to drink, being very fatigued, these kinds of things. And so you just have this real window, I think, into at least his experience. And I was curious, as a physician and I'm a nephrologist now, how that shapes how you care for people. How has that shaped your work as a physician?
Yeah, I think it definitely has had a tremendous impact, and I don't think I'm that different from anybody else in training, in that I was, as a resident, I was very concerned about, you know, getting the work done, getting the orders written, you know, what the numbers look like, and so I could get to sleep sometime soon. But not really paying a whole lot of attention, unfortunately, to, you know, the person living with this illness and really understanding what they are going through in the day-to-day. And so my involvement with Robert, for those who haven't read any of the book yet, he was on dialysis and had been on dialysis for several years when I met him, and I was a primary care doctor at the time. And so, of course, through our involvement, I very much got to see a much deeper side of what a person with kidney failure on dialysis is going through in the day-to-day. And that certainly made me, I think it gave me a much deeper sense of empathy. Mm-hmm. And also just having been a patient myself and being on that other side and seeing what it is that we do to people in the hospital with like those 4 a.m. Vital signs checks,
yeah.
Because the surgeons are going to be rounding soon or, you
right.
know, whatever. And I really think it's good in terms of when I am interacting with my patients in a day-to-day, because I get to talk to them from a place of experience and not just because I heard a lecture about it or because, you know, I read about it in a book. So
mm-hmm.
I think it does give me a little bit of maybe kind of a leg up, if you will, in terms of trying to build that extra level of rapport with people,
mm-hmm.
in terms of helping them come to terms with and cope with their own illness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, makes sense. One of the things I actually found pretty fascinating, I think, as a physician myself, was some of what you spoke about, yours and Robert's impressions of different physicians
mm-hmm.
taking care of them. Sometimes you didn't always agree on that,
mm-hmm.
right? But at one point in the book, you described two different, very different nephrologists
mm-hmm.
that he's had. And actually, I was going to, if it's okay with you, I was going to read a little bit.
Okay.
Because you put it so well. And I have, just take me a second to find the page here. So the two nephrologists are Gorman and Kravitz, are the names that you
yeah.
give these people. So yeah, as much as Robert liked Gorman, who was his earlier nephrologist, he disliked Kravitz. Gorman wanted to see Robert every 3 weeks. He wanted him to get blood and urine tests before the appointments. At the appointments, Gorman seemed genuinely interested in him as a person. He reviewed the test results ahead of time and explained them. Kravitz was content to see Robert once a year, ordered the tests at the visits, then never called with the results. And even worse, Kravitz never remembered Robert from visit to visit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Can Can you talk about that a little bit, just what you learned about the way physicians relate to, or nephrologists perhaps in particular, relate mm-hmm. to patients, and how that's sort of informed your practice?
Well, I guess some of it gets back to the person that Robert is, and you know, just an intelligent person, and really wanting to find someone to partner with him, and often feeling like physicians weren't willing to be a partner, that that we were too often talking down to him or discounting what he had to say. And so to hear about his experiences certainly made me, you know, be just more aware of that when I talk with people. And, you know, like, for example, somebody will say, you know, they have some kind of strange symptom since I started this medication. And even if I've never heard of anybody having anything like that, then for me now it's like, okay, benefit of the doubt, you know, yourself, you know what's going on, and we'll work right. and figure out something else. I think a physician that really made a huge impact on Robert, and I can't remember if I had this practice before or after he told me about it, but he had a primary care doctor whom he really liked, because he was willing to be that partner. And this was in kind of the early stages of Robert being on dialysis. And Robert came in to see him and didn't know his medications. And the doc was, you know, he said, you know what, you're a smart guy. You got to be on top of this. You got to know your medications. You got to fully participate, or else I can't really help you mm-hmm. to my best ability. And even though Robert was kind of being a little, you know, like slapped on the wrist, he really appreciated the doctor acknowledging that he was a person that could understand and be thoughtful about things, and just challenging him to mm-hmm. be a really active participant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, makes sense. One of the things that struck me, I mean, you do a fabulous job describing some of the tension and the difficulty around the actual kidney transplant, mm-hmm. and Robert in particular had some complications with the procedure, and you know, that was. Do the suspense really came across in that description? You know, really, really difficult time. But at one point, you talk about the fact that you're waiting for Robert to come out of the operating room, and you want to go there and comfort him and be there for him. And the nurses, the staff, tell you they're not ready for you, and you have to wait a long time. And you made a comment, you said, you know, in our healthcare system, you know, I think we should show more to family. I don't think we should be sort of hiding things and waiting till you said it much better than I'm saying it. But can you speak about that? Because I thought that was a really interesting insight.
Yeah, I mean, I understood what they were doing. They wanted everything to be just so, and a nurse to get all of her stuff done, and everything to be made pretty so that you're not seeing any of the dirty linens or, you know, blood anywhere and all of that. And so when you walk into the room, the person is lying there with the sheets nicely folded and pressed down, and they're looking so peaceful. But in reality, you know, when we're in like the ICU and you see people are being suctioned, and you know, there's just snot and blood and poo and all kinds of stuff everywhere. But that, and people are groaning and it being turned and all these things, but that's part of taking excellent care of our patients. And I think because we don't allow family to see what goes into taking excellent care of people, that they tend to, I think it means that they allow more than they mm-hmm. would had they known mm-hmm. that this is what happens mm-hmm. to their loved one every mm-hmm. day. And so that was just me making a point that I wish that we would allow people to see the truth more mm-hmm. often, because when we don't, people fixate on tiny little details mm-hmm. that have nothing to do with the big picture of, you know, how the person is doing and how their life is and, mm-hmm. and what we are really hoping for, and if all the things that we are doing are gonna help us achieve that or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, I think the other piece which you sort of conveyed emotionally was that it also would be can be a tremendous stressful endeavor for family also to be able to be with their loved one at those times. Because it reminds me a little bit of some of that work on showing family members what a code looks like and allowing them to be in the code. And you know, of course, that's a whole different topic, but interesting.
Yeah, the particular part in the book when they delayed me going to see Robert, when he woke up, he was alone, and all he saw was a dialysis machine, and you know, it had been a really tough hospital stay for him, and he had multiple surgeries, and for him to wake up and no one be there and see a dialysis machine, that was like the breaking point for him. And he thought, okay, the kidney is gone, I messed up, it's over. And the nurse did rush up and explain to him, no, you just have so much extra fluid, but you know, things are okay, everything's okay. But I wish that I could have been there and have comforted him during that time. So, yeah.
About 23 minutes, should we?
We could open it up.
So
we're happy to keep talking, but we did want to open it up to you all, and if anyone had any questions you wanted to ask. Yes, sir.
You talk about racial disparities in terms of access to organs. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar with Harriet Washington's Medical Apartheid, but she devotes a lot of that text to talking about the history of exploiting and consuming mm-hmm. black bodies. Can you relate that to your work?
Yeah, I think even before I wrote this book, I wrote an essay in Health Affairs, which is a health policy journal, about the experience that I had with Robert, seeing the kidney transplant system a little bit up closer, and it was amazing to me, and not in a good way, because I was already a primary care doctor. And to not know that's how the system worked was really disturbing to me. And as I sat there listening to the different people talking in a way that made us feel like they were trying to discourage Robert from even wanting a kidney transplant, and then knowing all the issues around insurance and all of that, it certainly sat there thinking, why you all are surprised that there's disparities in who gets a kidney transplant? Just look at the way the system is set up. And as I went into nephrology, I could see that it's not just about once you get to the kidney transplant center. There are so many things before a person ever gets there that I think strongly contributes. And for example, people have to know that they have kidney disease first to be in care. We know that a lot of people aren't aware of their kidney disease at all. And to be in care, you have to have access to physicians, and not just any physician, you need a nephrologist. And then that nephrologist has to look at you and think, oh, you would be a great candidate for kidney transplant, and make the referral. So I feel like along the way, there are all these places that our biases, subconscious, conscious, whatever, can come up and interfere with people having equal access to this. And so I certainly do see a big part of it, and it's something that I think did play out for Robert as well. So as an example, when he started dialysis, it was kind of under an emergency type of situation. And it was just a foregone conclusion that this is what he was going to do. And he took it upon himself to start researching and trying to find out about transplant and what it was all about and if it would be a good option for him. And he brought it up to his nephrologist. And this was a year after he had been on dialysis, and he said, oh yeah, sure, of course. So it's not like it was even a conscious thing that he wasn't referring Robert in particular, but you know, time is life when it comes to end-stage kidney disease, and he could have been listed for a transplant long before he even started dialysis. And so, and it's not just something that I'm, coming up with from our experience. There's plenty of research out there that shows that people are not having the same access to transplant Black people in particular as whites. So, yeah, and it is a prominent thing that I talk about in the book. Yes, sir.
Dr., two-part question.
Okay.
Can you describe the symptoms of kidney failure, life expectancy, and who is not a candidate for the transplant? Secondly, what is the significance of the title?
Okay. Okay. Let's see, I'll take the easy one first.
Yeah.
So the title, Hundreds of Interlaced Fingers, it comes from, I think because they have the, well, I guess I'll just start with the part that marketing and the publishing house, they come up with all of this because they know what will attract people. And so I think a lot of people, they think about relationships and hand-holding and that kind of thing. But in truth, there's a, I forget which chapter it is now, but I am describing the kidney on an electron microscopic level. And I'm talking about the kidneys, each has like a million each of filtering units. And this, to create the filters, there's all these fingers that interlace and create these slits for, you know, like water and waste to come through but hold back all the really important things. And so that's where it came from, me describing the kidney in a way that I wanted just anybody walking down the street to be able to understand the kidney, which to me, as I went into nephrology, just seemed like such this incredibly beautiful thing, and but nobody knows about it, you know, not really, and a lot of people don't even know that we have two or where they are, and all the wonderful things that kidneys do. So that's where the title comes from. So, and to your other question, you know, I find myself saying often that the best thing about kidney failure is the same as the worst thing about kidney failure, that people don't really have symptoms until it's really, really late and it's almost over. And by that I mean we love for our patients to feel well, so it's wonderful that people feel well until there's almost no kidney function. But on the flip side, it's really hard to get people to believe you that something is wrong with their kidneys and really take action to prepare for what we know as the inevitable. So that to me is the worst thing about it as well. So I guess in terms of, you asked about symptoms and who's eligible for transplant. There are some rare conditions where people like will suddenly, and we have other nephrologists in the audience too, and everybody can weigh in. But sometimes people will develop like sudden swelling of their legs and they'll be sick, like throwing up or whatever, and they'll end up in the hospital for that. But for most people, it just kind of ticks away really slowly over time. And the majority of kidney failure in this country is from just longstanding high blood pressure and diabetes. And so it's not until a person is close to needing dialysis that they develop the bigger symptoms, like feeling nauseated or vomiting, feeling short of breath, feeling just really extra fatigued and swelling getting worse. So those are the bigger ones. And in terms of transplant, a lot of things go into it. For example, one of the things that bothers me the most is that people have insurance that will pay for the evaluation. And because I practice at a public hospital, and you know, there's a lot of younger people don't have insurance, and so that delays them getting on the kidney transplant list, which is another issue about the race disparities that we see. And really, all of it boils down to, all the requirements boils down to the fact that there aren't enough kidneys to go around. People are dying every day waiting, wanting a kidney transplant. And so because it's such a scarce resource, they really want to make sure that the people that they give them to are going to take the best absolute care of them. And so if you're smoking, that just suggests you're not going to take good care of the kidney. It's going to damage it. If you are using drugs or, you know, all this kind of thing, if you're not taking care of your health in general in any way. In terms of age, there's not a real exact cutoff. Some, ooh, goodness, I got loud. some people, it's you know, kind of in the early 70s. And but then I think some transplant centers will, they'll make exceptions based on the person because, I mean, of course, you know, every 70-year-old is not the same. And particularly if they have someone that can donate a kidney to them. So hope that answered your question pretty well. Yes.
So how do you deal with kidney patients who are in denial?
you have some examples. I mean, at least one example.
Yeah, it's really tough. And what I try to do is, I understand that people are just so afraid of the unknown, and I try to acknowledge to with people that, you know, I get it. I know this is really hard, and I wish we weren't here, but it's not going away. And, you know, it's really in your best interest if we just face it. And I've seen lots of people that try to run away. They try to run away from the kidney failure, but it always catches them. So, and sometimes it works, and sometimes you just don't get through. And because for some people, you know, it's hard to believe things when you think you're doing okay, and or you think there's going to be a miracle for you that makes everything different, improves all the doctors wrong. But it is a day-to-day frustration watching someone go down a path much harder than you know it has to be.
If you wrote a book about dialysis discrimination, is that how I would have thought it? But you added a love story, that's great.
Thank you.
But I wanted to ask, how often do you share with patients and colleagues the fact that you are a kidney patient and that you're a caregiver for a kidney patient?
Mm-hmm.
And how does that, what happens? Is it a source of strength and connection, or is it a source of vulnerability and how does it
you know, I readily share it, and I think particularly if I'm talking to someone who is facing needing a kidney transplant, because, you know, just from my own husband knowing that it's hard to ask for a kidney, you know, that's is, you know, it's hard to ask somebody for $100. You think about asking for a kidney. And a lot of it is that people really are afraid of putting anyone that they care about in harm's way. And so what I share with my patients is, you know, that I am a donor, and I would do it again in a heartbeat. And and I don't think I'm that different than any other donor in that the risk that you take is just pales in comparison to how much you're going to benefit that person, and the risks are quite small. And so I say all of this to people to encourage them to be willing to accept a donation from someone that they care about. And I do think the fact that I am a caregiver as well, I think it does help in terms of building that rapport, helps it kind of create some endearing between my patients and myself that I think helps. I've not seen a downside to me sharing that I'm a donor or that my husband is, you know, a kidney patient.
So related to that, when you decided, was it a snap decision to donate, or did you think long and hard? And what were your thought processes?
It was kind of just spur of the moment decision, because when we started dating, I knew he was on the deceased donor wait list, and in my mind, okay, he'll get a kidney soon and it'll be fine. And I it hadn't occurred to me that I would be the source of his transplant until the day that we were sitting at the kidney transplant center, sitting in that clinic, and, you know, I'm hearing all of these things that made me feel like he might not get a fair shake with the system. And because we got there because they said he was, you know, at the top of the list. And then someone said, well, you know, for you, it might be another year. And like, why for him? And the person said, well, because we just don't get that many old organs. And talking about blood type, which made zero sense. And so it just didn't feel right. And that was just one of the things that didn't feel right. And so it was really in that moment that I thought, I should just see if I can give you a kidney. And in his, you know, ready response was, no, I don't want to do that. And so really, I didn't say anything else to him. I just went about, you know, going through the evaluation to make sure that I was healthy enough to donate to him. And I didn't bring it up again until I said, oh, they say we're compatible, and here's the surgery date. and he was, oh, okay. And, you know, I guess she's serious about this. And that, so by at that point, he could accept that, all right, this is, she clearly wants to do it. Because, you know, I wasn't the first one who said to him, like, just try to see if I can give you a kidney. And, you know, I get that it's a big deal. And even though I don't consider myself being particularly special because I donated, and I think another 5,000 people donated the year that I donated. So but I guess so, because there are a lot of people that are in need of kidney transplants that don't get one. And so there were people that they said they would, and then they just kind of, you know, went away or tipped back into the shadows and never said something. And that was tough. That was tough for Robert in that, you know, because you can't be, and I wrote about this in the book, it's not fair to be mad at somebody for not giving you a kidney, not going through with it. And I personally didn't have any doubts about it, which is strange. I just believed that I was going to be fine. I had a little boy from my first marriage. He was like 4 years old at the time. I just assumed, okay, I'll have my sister come out. She'll look after him for a couple days, and then mommy will be back home. You know, it didn't occur to me that I could just be gone. And it's very, very rare for kidney donors to die, but it has happened. And I don't really think that I appreciated the bigness of the whole thing until the day of surgery. And I remember lying there in the pre-op space, and I was just so nervous. My tummy was just flipping. But at the same time, I was so happy because I felt like, you know, yesterday was the last day that Robert was going to have dialysis. And then the nurse gave me Valium and said, okay, it's almost time to go through the IV. And I was just, you know, wide awake and like, oh, okay. And the surgeons came and they were rolling me to the elevator. So how are you feeling? You feeling sleepy? No, not at all. I feel wide awake. And the next thing I remember is the nurse in recovery shaking me, Vanessa, we're all done. I'm like, oh my God. I thought I was going to get to count backwards in the operating room. That there would be that split second to say, no, I can't. I don't want to do it. Not that I would. That would be the most awful thing to do to anybody ever. But it just, in that moment, it just struck me like, oh my God, that was a big deal. I could just not be here anymore. And but then I was just so happy about it because I looked over, Robert and I in recovery weren't close enough to touch, but close enough for me to see the grin on his face and to see this bag from the catheter and his bladder just collecting all of this yellow pee, and it was just the most wonderful thing. And I don't know, it was one of definitely top three best decisions in my life, and I would readily do it again, been in the situation over again.
So how did you find time to write this book?
Yeah, I have a day job and a kid and husband. Thankfully I'm a morning person, and so I got the idea from reading Stephen King's book on writing, and there was a section in it where he talked about his writing practice. And you know, I mean, he's Stephen King, and that's what he does for a living. And he talked about how he would write 10,000 words every day, and sometimes he would be done at like 1 in the afternoon, and sometimes he would be well into the evening. And But then there, and you know, it's like, I have a day job, I can't possibly do that. But then he talked about this man who worked at the post office who had a regular 9-to-5 and how this guy would get up early and he would write for 2-3 hours before he went to work. And I thought, oh, I can do that. But so that meant my day had to start at 4 in the morning. So I would get up at 4, I would write for a couple hours, and then, you know, maybe even get in a little exercise, and then, you know, my son and I get ready and get going to school and work for the day. And I did that on the weekends, too. I would get up at 4, write for a couple hours, and I would go sit at Starbucks and write until, like, lunchtime, and then take off to go have lunch and hang out with my family so they wouldn't be too angry with me through this whole writing process. But yeah, took a couple years, but there were other hands.
Doctor, what's the prognosis for living with one kidney?
It's pretty good, pretty good. There's a study that came out recently that showed that there's a slight increased risk of donors developing kidney failure. But at the time when I was donating, the message that was given was that, donors live just as long as the general population. Well, the general population can be quite sick. So since then, they've done some work to compare living donors with people who could have been donors but didn't. And so it does show that there's some slight increased risk. I don't even remember the exact numbers in this study. You know, I don't really care because it doesn't matter. But what I knew is that my remaining kidney would, over the next weeks or months, would grow to compensate for at least 80-85% of total kidney function. And I knew that I could live just fine with that for the rest of my life. And, you know, that was good enough. Yes?
I think I can answer that for you. My brother gave me a kidney when he was 21. He's extremely healthy, and now he's 60.
He's doing great. We're only 12 years down the path, but yeah, I'm doing well.
I've had some other things going in between. It wasn't
there was a hand back here.
I was going to ask how long ago this was. My calculation was about 12 years, and he's still going strong with that kidney.
Yeah, he hasn't required any dialysis since the hospitalization. That was a rough time, but he's not been on dialysis at all since then, and he's, you know, able to work full time, and, you know, he's doing great. Yeah.
So you mentioned that you started this because you had a topic you wanted to talk about. Would you think, is there another topic out there you want to talk about that you would, like, think about doing a fictional story or anything about?
You know, I really wish I had, like, a Twilight or a 50 Shades of Grey kind of idea, but none of that has come to me at this point. I don't know. Fiction, I don't know. It's like real life is just so crazy and amazing. To do fiction hasn't really, a great idea hasn't come to me. And if you had asked me, like, I don't know, 3-4 months ago, and people did, so when's your next book coming out? And I was like, oh my God, I just gave birth. Can I just heal? Can I have a little time to heal? But now, as I, you know, I'm going around talking more about what's in the book and even thinking more about things, I don't know what it will be yet, but I actually think, maybe I do have another book. So, you know, stay tuned.
Just not that much drama.
No, I'm not going to give away any more parts. It won't be based upon that. Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe this is too big a question, but the New York Times review said that you, in the book, you talk about discrimination in the workplace, in academic medicine. Can you give a little synopsis of what you might talk about in the book?
Yeah, well, I think the majority of what I talk about is how medicine is just strange in that how race plays out within medicine. And it's crazy to me because, you know, you think about science as supposed to be this, like, really true thing, but yet we lend a lot to race, which is this social construct. You know, we made it up, and it's not based upon any gene. And so for us to give so much weight to it in our management and taking care of people, I find particularly disturbing. And one of the things that I talk about in the book is we're kind of in this country. I don't think it's the same everywhere, but in this country, we're pretty much trained to give the race of the person along with age and gender, like in the first sentence when you're what we call presenting a case, when you're talking to others about a patient. And we use all the information in the case presentation to think about, well, what could be going on that has caused this sickness in this individual. And so everything that you say makes you kind of subconsciously or consciously think about things. So if you say a 30-year-old person, then you're automatically only thinking about things that affect younger people. You're not thinking about stuff that affects somebody who's 80 years old. If you say a woman, you're not gonna think about stuff that is only affects, you're not gonna think about a prostate issue, for example. And if you say race, then you're gonna color however the individual is, you know, whatever things they're carrying around about race. And I think it makes us lazy, and it makes us take shortcuts that can be very dangerous. And a particular story that I talk about in the book is when I was in training, this this well-known rheumatologist, like arthritis doctor, was presenting us a case of a 40-year-old black woman who had symptoms that were, you know, clearly went along with this specific diagnosis that is very common among younger black women. But at the end of the case, he revealed that the diagnosis was very much delayed for the patient, because in truth, the patient was himself. This well-known middle-aged white man, you know, rheumatologist, he was delayed in diagnosing his own symptoms, because in his own mind, this was something that, you know, young black women had, and it couldn't even occur to him that he would have it. And so to me, that was just like the hugest example of how it is a double-edged sword, and we're not doing anybody favors by taking those kind of shortcuts.
You actually told a story in the book too about how you deliberately presented a case mm-hmm. in conference where you left out the race.
Yeah.
Can you speak about that?
Yeah. And I think that gets to maybe your question too, in terms of how it feels to how race plays out just among colleagues. So I presented this case, and I just said a 26-year-old man comes in with blood in his urine and a really high blood pressure. And the first question, before I could even get all that out of my mouth, one of my peers asked, "So, what was the race?" And, you know, I was being kind of flippant about it. I said, "Green. What difference does it make?" You know. And this person, you know, my sarcasm completely went over his head, and he went through this long kind of detail about, well, if he's Asian, then it's more likely to be this, and if he's black, it's, you know, this, and I was just like, oh my God, for real? But everybody else was kind of nodding along, and so it just struck me at how it's so ingrained that when these types of assumptions fit in with what we believe, nobody questions it. And particularly, and that's one of the reasons why I feel like it's so important that we have diversity in all these settings, particularly in medicine, because it takes somebody who sees the world differently, who has a different experience, to point out, like, you know what, that's not okay. But as the person who is pointing things out a lot, it does get hard, and I do take some flack for it from time to time, but, you know, what are you gonna do? Can't stay quiet. Yes, sir.
What's your response? Oprah Winfrey just did the Henrietta Lacks movie based mm-hmm. on Rebecca Skloot's book, mm-hmm. The Tuskegee Experiment, which is mentioned explicitly in Harriet Washington's book. Mm-hmm. What's your response that this is not a problem of racial biases, or people are just not well informed, they're just operating off these assumptions, that this is a deliberate continuation of exploiting black bodies?
It's really it's sad to me that in medicine, we tend to think we're somehow outside of general society. And I don't understand how we could even come close to believing that, given that we have all this historical evidence of how race plays out in medicine. And at the same time, I think a lot of us will acknowledge, okay, yes, there are race disparities in medicine, that this group is doing worse than this group. But I think for the most part, people think it's somebody else's fault. It's them over there. They're the ones that have, they're being discriminatory, and they're the ones that have created these problems. It's not us. Everybody thinks it's somebody else. And anytime it comes up, people spend so much time defending themselves that we never really get a chance to talk about the real issues and make any headway. An example that's not even really about race is, did folks see the John Oliver thing where he just reamed the DeVita to Halesis and a little bit to Fresenius? So I was in this Twitter social media conversation about it, and it was the same thing where people were trying to distance themselves, like, well, yes, I work there, but this is what we do, and the staff are really dedicated and all of this. And there, I made the same point. It's like, if we're just going to spend our time trying to distance ourselves from a bad thing, then we're never going to, make any solution or make any headway with resolving the bad thing. So I don't know if that answered your question, but. Okay, well, we can certainly talk more if you want to hang out for a while. But I think we're coming close to the end of our hour, and we certainly wanted to not keep everybody all night. And if anybody has a book that they would like for me to sign, I never grow tired of signing this book. So I'm happy to have folks come up. I think, where did Miss Lizzie go? I think she was going to bring me. We were gonna close out and do some signing. So thank you all so much for coming out. I really appreciate it. Books are there.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.